Oh, welcome. And more and more, I really like to hold the teaching seat as more of a conversation rather than an academic presentation or even a discourse. So maybe we'd be willing to start. Would anyone, or a few people, be willing to just say in a couple words what your present moment's experience is like just now? Couple of words. Yeah. Okay. Petting a dog. Feelings of pleasure and happiness. Yeah. Anyone else?
Mentally busy.
Still, it's already been 45 minutes.
Watery.
Okay. A bit of unease and worry.
Unease and worry. Anyone else? Moments of worry? Be one more.
Safety.
Thank you. Oh, thank you for offering that. It helps me at the beginning to feel like this is more of an exchange, more of a dialogue. And we'll be kind of exploring, so the whole month of December, kicking off tonight this exploration of the last factor of the Eightfold Path, which is right concentration or wise concentration. And it refers to this quality of mind, this capacity of mind that's gathered together. So I was noticing as I rang the bell to call everyone back to the sit, it was this experience of kind of dispersal. And then there was this slow gathering together as people came back. So it's this inherent capacity of mind that we have to collect, to gather around a center. So we can have all sorts of associations with the word concentration. I know for me it would always generate images of like number two pencils, and when those used to exist, and just filling in very small little dots. So it was felt like very like target practice almost. And since practicing, my kind of experience and understanding of this word samadhi has grown as well. So when I looked it up in the dictionary, I find this is always a helpful place to start for talks, two definitions just in the standard Merriam-Webster. One is close attentiveness, single-mindedness, tunnel vision. And the example of a sentence is frowning in concentration. So there's a sense of a frown, constriction, narrowing. And the second one is closer to what I was describing, watching you all come back. It's a close gathering of people or things. The largest concentration of Canadian geese on earth. Largest concentration. So you get a sense of something coming into harmony, coordination, gathering together. So I'd like to kind of offer or suggest for your reflection that rather than concentration being this kind of furrowing of one's brow, this narrowing of experience and trying to pin it to a point, that it may have more of a sense of gathering in fragmented parts of ourselves together, gathering in different aspects of the mind, different energies. So some teachers talk about it as body, mind, and heart unifying together, kind of collecting together. So it also makes the mind, when it's gathered or collected, it makes it very potent and serviceable. So we can use it. Sometimes this seems to me like concentrated orange juice, right? Or a concentrated essence of something. It means that it's not being diluted or dispersed, and that it has kind of its essence that can be used for whatever you want. You can use that orange juice for a variety of things. Right? So different ways to kind of approach this faculty. In Pali, it's samadhi. Right? And what goes right along with it is a deep sense of pleasantness and well-being. So this kind of goes against the sort of furrowing, kind of clenched fist concentration, because it's accompanied by a deep inner sense of well-being. It feels good to be collected, to not be fragmented, to not be dispersed. So we all have had experiences of this, and it's helpful to keep in mind that this is a rather ordinary state of mind that can be developed, cultivated, and used in the service of awakening. So my husband last night came back as I was looking over my reflections for the talk. He came back and had seen this movie about the rock climber, the documentary Free Solo. Has anyone heard about this? I thought, okay, I have not seen it. I just got the secondhand experience. But this man who was scaling these rocks in Yosemite, I believe it was, without any support, without any ropes, just, I won't go into the whole thing, but just unbelievable power of concentration. So of course, my husband came home, I said, so tell me what his mind was like. What was it like? What was his state of mind in doing this? And because just this incredible power to be able to do this. And he said oftentimes, he didn't care about the camera at all, but oftentimes he would turn around and there was just a feeling of joy and delight at this, right? So they also did, I think actually did an MRI on his brain. This is going into a tangent, but I'm gonna cut it off. They did an MRI of his brain, and his experience of fear was greatly reduced. So the point being that this is a quality that can be cultivated in a variety of settings, but that there is this quality of joy, well-being in the capacity of the mind to be absorbed in something, right? So in meditation, we take that capacity and we develop it in the service of awakening, right? That's what makes it sama samadhi, right samadhi. Right samadhi is what makes it right or wise is that it's connected to the other factors of the Eightfold Path, so it sort of rests on our ethical sensitivity and integrity. So it's not the concentration of someone trying to crack a safe or trying to break in to a house, you know, trying to mastermind some sort of crime. It's not that kind of concentration. It rests on our ethical sensitivity, and it leads to, it develops, it culminates in awakening. So it's helpful to think of it, approach it as kind of couched by sila on the one hand, our ethical foundation, and wisdom, you know, learning, understanding, and the kind of release that leads towards awakening on the other. Right? So this is what makes it sama samadhi. So in my experience, this quality tends to be either undervalued by teachers and practitioners or overvalued, right? Which is, our minds go to extremes. So we tend to either think that this is the most important thing to do, tell me the steps to get there. I want bliss, I want it now, you know, I want these ecstatic states, that must mean that I'm doing it right, that something's happening, give me the map, let me at it. And anything else is a kind of failure. And so there's this real, it can really activate our sense of striving. And so especially if we start out this way in practice, we can very easily, when we find how tight and constricted and difficult that makes things, we can very, very easily throw up our hands and say, forget about samadhi, you know, forget about it. It's not important, I'm not going to practice it, jhana, shmanas, just forget it. So then I think we do a real disservice to this kind of potency that our mind is capable of. Right? So what is the middle path between thinking that samadhi is the only reason for practicing, the only purpose, and how can I get there? It's usually very me-oriented. Or just dismissing it. Well, I'm not good at it, so why bother? Right? So how can we approach it? How can our relationship to it be somewhere in the middle so we can use it, cultivate it, develop it, but know that it's not an end point. It's not the culmination of the practice, but it's a very powerful tool on the path. Okay, so what I'll speak about a little bit are maybe some of the benefits of samadhi, some of the difficulties or some of the obstacles we get into. And then some kind of more helpful approaches. All right, so good Buddhist fashion, at least Western Buddhist fashion, like what is it? What helps? What hinders? Go for it. So what's helpful is part of this middle way is appreciating it as kind of an art, right? That we can feel our way into as we practice. And as any artist who stayed with it over time knows, there's an appreciation for one's own unique way of creating, of making art, right? It doesn't look quite like anyone else's way, but there's something about a commitment, a returning to something regularly over time, and a way in which we can get out of our own way, right? To allow something natural to unfold on its own. So often I'll have the most beautiful Dharma discussions with friends who are artists because they understand that process. So concentration, I feel, is much the same way. We have to kind of dive into the pool for ourselves and understand what allows us that sense of relaxing back enough to, like the sense of self gets thinner, and what puts us into a mode of receptivity, appreciation, and opening, rather than commanding experience or masterminding experience, right? So it's a bit of an art that we have to feel our way through. And the Buddha described it on his path very clearly, at least as the story goes. He had tried a variety of practices to kind of overcome or transcend his limitations. So he tried a lot of austerities and concentration practices with a lot of effort. And his understanding grew that this isn't the right direction. I'm getting more and more emaciated, I'm getting more frail, my mind is getting brittle. But more importantly, this doesn't eradicate my suffering. This doesn't alleviate my suffering. So what else is there? This is one of the most moving parts for me of his story, is that this image came to mind of being a young boy, about nine, boy of about 8 or 9. And it was a very kind of organic image of sitting underneath a rose apple tree. There in the distance was, I think, it was an agrarian society, so there was a festival, some farming kind of festival going on in the distance. So his community was there, but he was a bit secluded, a bit set apart. And very naturally, as he relaxed against the support of this tree, his mind connected with the ease and pleasantness of receiving the breath, just in that moment as a young child. And the thought occurred to him, might this be a better way towards my own awakening? This natural ability, like when the mind is relaxed, at ease, supported in safety, like with others, but somewhat secluded, might this hold some information for me? And so he set about to practice in this way. And this he found to be a much more supportive condition for exploring his own mind. So this natural sense of well-being, of ease, of relaxation. And it's talked about again and again as the kind of happiness that's born of seclusion. Right? Happiness and a pleasure that's born of seclusion. So it's different than the happiness and pleasure of an ice cream cone, right? Or of, you know, watching a perfect Netflix movie, even having a wonderful conversation. It's a different kind of happiness that's based on letting go, that's nourished by the mind's capacity to let go. So it's a gatheredness not based on acquisition, but on relinquishment, that willingness to sit back against the tree, to take a pause and to connect with what's already here in our experience. So we have a sense, we may already have a sense of some of the benefits of samadhi, but for those of us who've been at it a while, it may be worth reminding ourselves or just reappreciating what's beneficial about these states. For those of us who are newer to practice, we can also just get a sense of the naturalness of it and most likely, we're kind of dipping in to this without realizing it. I know for myself, it was a long time before I had kind of any deliberate instruction about some of these maps of absorption or concentration, and I was kind of dipping in and out of them without realizing it, but not really knowing where I was or how to cultivate or really how to appreciate them and put them in perspective. So one really key benefit of samadhi or gatheredness or this unification of mind is that it's this very deep sense of nourishment. So the mind is actually kind of regenerating in those moments. So for most of us, myself included, our kind of natural default setting these days when it's like just a flood of information, moment to moment, really can feel many times like the world is on fire, literally and figuratively. And so how do we hold all of that? How do we find any sense of ground in all of that? And we can feel quite depleted often. So most people come to practice with this deep craving, longing for rest, for a sense of rest, for a sense of time and space, and a deep sense of rest. So this is from Ayakema, the primary female meditation masters in this lineage, one of them. She said, and this was 20 years ago or so, before Facebook, I think. "We're overworking the finest, most delicate, most valuable tool that exists in the universe, the mind. Then we're surprised that things don't work out the way we thought they should, and that the world we live in is not the kind of paradise it ought to be. Our minds cannot function at full capacity, being totally overworked. They've not had a rest, a cleanup, or any necessary medicine. Our minds are running downhill instead of regenerating. Meditation is our way of regenerating the mind." So sometimes this seems to me, you know, often before I'm preparing to go on retreat or go teach, I'll kind of shut down all of the windows and tabs that I have on the computer. So just, you know, those tend to expand and proliferate. So just one by one, I'll just shut them down. And there's a little relief at each one until finally there's that empty screen. Right? So there's a way that we've kind of accustomed, you know, acclimated ourselves to this barrage of information, of input. So allowing ourselves the time and space to experience these deeper levels of nourishment is like allowing a few of those windows to close. Right? So the happiness and pleasure born from seclusion. So one teacher, Ajahn Chandako, another also in the Thai forest tradition, says, "Samadhi generates energy and Vipassana puts it to work." So oftentimes we're ready to get to work, yeah? Get to insight, examine, investigate, but the mind is depleted. It actually doesn't have the energy to carry out that work. So we can start to get a sense of when is it time to really rest and nourish, and when is it time to investigate and examine. So appreciating the sense of rest. So this is from David White. I found this, and he talks about this deep sense of rest. "So to rest is to give up on the already exhausted will as the prime motivator of endeavor, with its endless outward need to reward itself through established goals. To rest is to give up on worrying and fretting and the sense that there's something wrong with the world unless we are there to put it right. To rest is to fall back, literally or figuratively, from outer targets and shift the goal not to an inner static bullseye, an imagined state of perfect stillness, but to an inner state of natural exchange." So when we start to experience this, and we can think of it as a relationship to silence or stillness too, and you know, I've experienced in myself this craving, this wanting to drink in silence or stillness as nourishment. Right? So when we're with this, when we're able to absorb into this to some degree, to let ourselves fully receive that experience of silence or stillness, our relationship to the hindrances starts to shift, right? So for a long time, it can seem like meditation is nothing more or barely more than a kind of battle with the hindrances. Right? I know it was like this for me for many years. This uphill battle against sleepiness, torpor, restlessness, doubt. Can I do this? Is this for me? Am I up to it? Where does this actually lead? This experience of wanting to jump out of one's own skin, jump out of the cushion, get out of here, anywhere but here. This slinking, kind of sinking, deep sluggishness of mind, and the fantasies, projections into the future, remembering the past, this ping-ponging between not wanting and not wanting. It can feel like just a guided tour through the hindrances, right? So what happens when we start to notice these gaps or this appreciation of stillness, silence, however kind of minimal or fleeting, in letting that naturally deepen, appreciating how the mind does gradually settle and collect, the nourishment that comes with that, our relationship to the hindrances changes. So we can no longer be fooled by believing that these hindrances are who I am. I am this angry person who can't meditate. You know, I am this doubtful, sluggish, kind of foggy mind. Right? So once we experience moments in which the hindrances are temporarily, we're protected from them temporarily, what samadhi is, our relationship to them shifts. And slowly, our baseline level of concentration and collectedness is different, right? It's different. So it's helpful, if we've been at this a while, to reflect on that. How is my just kind of baseline level of well-being, collectedness, how is that different from when I started? Is there a difference? Sometimes it's been so gradual that we can't fully appreciate it. And finally, another benefit is that this samadhi, or the collectedness and unification, makes the mind both strong, kind of resilient, and also malleable, I was saying in the beginning. It feels like I'm kind of clay that's been softened, right? It's no longer fragmented, getting caught up, getting brittle, getting tight. It's moldable, so that when we aim it in a certain direction, that it's we can work with it. It's serviceable. It's serviceable for wisdom, right? So we can feel this, we can experience this. Example I often use that in the beginning, when we're kind of more in this default mode of fragmentation, it's like our view is as though you hand a preschooler a phone to take a video, right? So I have a 5-year-old, and sometimes he'll want to take a video, and for brief moments, it lapses in judgment, you could say. I'll hand him my phone, and the video that he takes is, you get a lot of corners and ceilings and floors, feet, colors, and it's this dizzying just movement all over the place, right? So this is, so often, this is our experience of the mind, is not only fragmentation, but just this dizzying array. It's very difficult for us to get a sense of clarity or wisdom when the world is spinning, right? Very difficult to see how things actually are and to learn when it's this kind of kaleidoscope of color. So really allowing ourselves to settle. And it's often felt to me, the dog is a wonderful example, that what we do, we can't make ourselves settle down. You can't command yourself to relax or settle, but what you can do is make a very inviting nest for that kind of wild beast of our mind that would love nothing more to just run free in the woods. A very comfortable place for it to just rest, right? So this comes from the attitude of mind with which we practice. Practice with kindness, with an invitation to come home, settledness, a sense of safety, being in the company of others, and slowly, it's like the animal circles around, like cats do this sometimes, they knead their paws into something comfortable, and then they drop. So this is more like establishing the conditions. This is what we have responsibility for. Just setting up those conditions. So a few things that get in our way, and maybe I don't have to list them for you, you may already know, but is impatience with this process, right? We tend to want results now. Okay, this is what I'm after, this kind of goal orientation, let me get it right now. And with that sense of aversion, we can't settle. So I would, kind of a crude example, but often my father had a stroke and I helped care for him for a number of years and he was very impeded in what he could take in. And so I would invite him to when he was agitated, just notice one breath, Dad. Are you able to just notice one breath coming in, coming out? You know, just what's that like? You're like, that just doesn't work for me. That does not work for me. Right? So you go, that doesn't work for me. Right? There's this feeling that if we can't feel the results immediately, it's not effective. Right? It's again more of this art form, this kind of circling, this entering into a process, and an appreciation that something develops gradually over time. And even being able to touch that a little bit is pleasurable, right? Can bring joy and happiness, right? We're not all the way there. It's not a full, complete experience, but we can taste it, even just a little bit. And that is pleasurable. There can be appreciation in that. So as these experiences get deeper, we can feel that nourishment. So I've been on, had the chance to go on longer retreats. You know, once I had the image, you know, on a longer 3-month retreat, being in a very supportive environment. It felt as though it was hooked up to an oxygen mask and drinking like just distilled water, just gulping distilled water and just breathing fresh, clean mountain air, right? So all at the same time, those are the images that are coming. Just very deep sense of nourishment. So an obstacles to that can be this impatience. It can also be not feeling as though we deserve that kind of happiness. So this is a good one to look at, our relationship to that kind of pleasure. We can have ideas in meditation that it's not really working unless it's difficult, unless it is this kind of arduous rock climb through the hindrances. It can feel like it's not really working. But the Buddha said again and again that this is the kind of pleasure that can be deepened, that can be developed, that can be used. So to take the nourishment, to take the rest. Right? So another obstacle can be kind of getting stuck in a state of, sometimes I'll call this like pseudo calm, right? Or it actually is calm, but pseudo samadhi. Feels calm, but when we come out of it, we don't have any idea where we've been, right? We weren't necessarily struggling, but it's been a bit of a blank out, a timeout, right? We're not exactly sure what happened. We've lost alertness. Well, plenty of calm, but no alertness. And we can experience this. You know, oftentimes people will ask, you know, I do feel calmer. People have been practicing for a while. I feel like some of those rougher edges have been kind of rounded a little bit. I do feel calmer. I do feel a little bit more steady, but is this it? Right? Is this it? Is this all that practice is about? Just feeling a little calmer? So this is good. This kind of questioning is good. But we can also kind of rest in these states that are a bit more pleasant than what we're used to, but aren't that kind of deeper nourishment that can be the jumping off point to wisdom. So we can lose alertness. Okay. So we can also not feel empowered to experiment. So I think this is really important, and it goes along with the kind of artful approach. So oftentimes we can feel like very good, diligent students, so just following instructions and not feeling like we are able to kind of let go a little bit of the instructions and trust our practice and also trust wise view. Trust the sensitivity to cause and effect. That when I do this, this is what happens. Right? So when I let go, when I lean back against the root of a tree, there's greater ease. Right? So trusting that. So oftentimes we don't feel like we can experiment. When we feel kind of pleasure or appreciation, what happens if we let that deepen? They're very actually clear and deliberate instructions to let the entire body be suffused, permeated, pervaded with the sense of well-being. So that's a very deliberate kind of act. So rather than being fixated around a point, it's actually letting something expand, open up, widen, right, in experience. So trusting that we can play with that. Mm-hmm. So one other obstacle is that we can forget about or neglect wise view. So this comes along with a sense of striving, but we can forget that this samadhi is in the service of awakening, right? That it's in the service of wisdom. I know that when it's been strong for me on retreat and I've gone to talk with teachers, you know, in those, especially the deeper states, there's a feeling like you don't need anything, right? So it changes our relationship to, you know, sensory pleasure. So you don't really need as much. But you're also not very interested in investigating, right? It's like, this feels pretty good. Why would I want to investigate? And so I'd have teachers kind of coax me and say, you know, just look, just try, just look a little bit, you know, just ask, what is this? What is this? What's here? Investigate. So again, not taking this as any kind of end point, not getting kind of seduced into these pleasures, but taking the nourishment and using it for wisdom. So one last thing that I'll mention, and I'll offer you a chance to contemplate this in your own way. So just a reminder, but that often when we're focused on concentration, we can completely forget the body kind of the kind of samadhi that I've been pointing to is an embodied samadhi. It's not about transcending the body, but it's really about filling it. One teacher who talks about this as, again, something that develops over time, but an awareness of the body. So as we start out in the first foundation of mindfulness, feeling as though there are two separate things. There's me aware of my body, me bringing mindfulness and awareness to the body becomes kind of the body of awareness, right? The body filled, nourished, pervaded with awareness. This is a very different vantage point. This is a very different view. So this is also one that will serve us well in daily life. Very difficult to have the attention fixed on one solid, immovable object in daily life. But a mind that's malleable, that's embodied, that has that sense of well-being, can move through a flux of circumstances and be very effective. So there's a very practical kind of concentration called momentary concentration, right? So rather than being directed at an object, it's directed at the changingness of each moment. So our experiences of being in a kind of flow in daily life have more to do with states of this momentary concentration. Part of a changing experience internally and externally, right? So a lot of this is getting to know with a kind of malleable mind different ways that concentration shows up. Goes with the freedom to experiment, right? So there's the kind of concentration that's more directed, where we bring the attention, we invite the attention to go back again and again to the breath or the body or sounds or an anchor, then we receive the sensations that are there. We deliberately direct the mind to one aspect of experience. So this is kind of what we're most familiar with. But there's also a way of being aware that many of us have played with where you don't direct the mind at all. You just let the mind, you let whatever arises, arise in the mind, but you stay aware. So this is often what I think about, of allowing the dog to settle or allowing the restless child to settle. You can direct it, you can coax it, you can, you know, give it its nest, but you can also let it out and let it roam, but stay aware. So one of my son's preschool teachers had this wonderful quote. It's an all-outdoor forest kindergarten. She said, "Children cannot bounce off the walls if you take away the walls." Right? So this is what we can do with the mind also. We can play rather than directing it, coaxing it. We can kind of let it out of any sort of constriction and just watch what it does. Watch what it learns, right? So this is also concentration. This is a form of concentration. It's helpful to know both and to know how to move in between the two. Well, we can play with this. So directed, undirected, momentary. But again, there's a sense of well-being, right? Because in those moments, we're not fighting with experience. We're aligned with experience. We're in a kind of more receptive mode, even though it can be quite active. We're not fighting with the way it is. So the similes that the Buddha used for this go right along with this idea of deep nourishment. So all of these similes of water, right? Of the happiness that comes when you've been walking through a desert and you see an oasis. You see some shade and water. And then you approach the oasis and you actually start drinking. The nourishment that comes with that, of a lake that is kind of fed from within, fed from a spring that kind of wells up from within it. Right? So to get to know the capacity of mind, this deep rest and nourishment, this makes us quite independent in practice, quite confident. It makes the mind strong, resilient, rested, and fed from within. So these similes of water. Okay. And maybe I'll just end with this from Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest master, and who a lot of kind of what I've been mentioning has been spoken about from teachers in his lineage. He says, "Wisdom is the movement of samadhi. It's like the phrase, still flowing water. The samadhi and the vipassana of someone who've developed right practice are in harmony and concord and flow like a single stream of water. In the mind of the practitioner, it's as if still water is flowing. The peace of samadhi incorporates wisdom. There's sila, samadhi, and panya, wisdom, together. Wherever you sit, it's still, and yet it flows. It's still flowing water. There's samadhi and panya, wisdom, samatha and vipassana." So why don't we just sit for a moment? This is again from the Buddha, the Samyutta Nikaya. "Just as the river Ganges flows toward the ocean, slopes toward the ocean, inclines toward the ocean, so too a practitioner who cultivates and develops states of samadhi flows, slopes, and inclines towards nibbana, towards freedom, towards awakening." So Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it. And it's possible to be concentrated while listening to a talk. I think that often happens. The mind becomes collected, unified, and often my experience of teaching is that the settledness of the minds in the room help enable the talk to come into being, right? I could feel that constantly. So thank you. And curious, your reflections, comments, questions, but also your own experiences with this topic. So sometimes teachers are even hesitant to even talk about it, right? To talk about concentration for fear that people will misunderstand it or think of it as a kind of goal. So curious your thoughts. What's coming up for you around that?
I feel like the teachers through Sims and in this tradition actually have been very clear about that concentration or is certainly not the end point.
Yeah.
And just a tool. And so while there's some alluringness about it, it's not quite the word.
Yeah.
It's easy to see that as just wanting something that may not be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you talked about it as a tool just makes so much sense. But I don't feel like that I have ever been taught or learned that, that's what I'm shooting for.
Mm-hmm.
Other than to use as a tool for wisdom.
Yeah.
So it feels pretty clear.
Good.
In terms of the intellectual.
Yeah, so she was saying, not sure if everyone can hear, but saying that it feels fairly clear in terms of kind of a framework or at least the intellectual part of understanding that samadhi is a tool. So in her experience, teachers haven't emphasized it as something that's absolutely necessary for awakening, but one tool. So for her, it feels clear.
Good. You reinforce that in a wonderful way.
Makes
her very happy.
So it makes her feel happy. Feeling that reinforced that it's not necessary or a requirement, I think. And most of my teachers have definitely been in that same instructed me in the same way. And I think where I went with that is kind of more on the undervaluing side of not, at least this is where I went, I'm not saying that it's where you went, but maybe of not appreciating, being a little afraid of that pleasure, right? Being afraid of that pleasure, that I would, get attached to it or get stuck there. So I was quite surprised and kind of doing some of my own investigation how much the Buddha encouraged drenching ourselves in that kind of pleasure and really taking in that kind of nourishment. So I think I kind of tipped more on the side of actually undervaluing, underappreciating. There's so many of these adjectives or verbs, not adjectives, about like savoring, this deep savoring of experience. So this is, I think, where practice really moves from becoming a philosophy, right? Like a good philosophy that we can appreciate, that's satisfying, to a deep nourishment, right? It requires this feeling sense, this direct experience, the capacity of the mind not just to be steered, but to actually take in what it's experiencing. So it's not just breathing in, breathing out, mechanical, one, two, three, four. That's helpful for the first part of direction, but it's actually a receptivity and a deep feeling of those sensations that leads to that kind of nourishment. So I think I was a little standoffish towards that kind of pleasure. I think I underestimated the capacity of the practice in that regard. A little afraid of it. Illicit drugs or something, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
But I can get drawn into, I mean, in this modern life, it's not really where it's directed. So there's so much of doing more and being more social and being more extroverted that it's just your talk is just a really wonderful support to my practice that it's okay. It nurtures me, and it brings me into samadhi, it brings me into wisdom, and so I really appreciate that. And I also want to ask, you talked about the flowing samadhi, the flowing awareness, or the momentary, isn't that similar to Vipassana?
Okay. Yeah. So our question, what kind of a two-part one? First, appreciating what feels like maybe the permission or the encouragement that it's okay to be quiet. All right. It's okay to do less. That's where the refuge of Sangha is so helpful, because you're around all of these other people who are also moving in a similar direction, and also the nourishment of sila, right? Of simplifying life and seeing how that supports well-being over and over again. So anyway, appreciating that. And then the question about Ajahn Chah's still flowing water, and what I said about momentary concentration. So isn't that Vipassana? That's a kind of samadhi that arises more through Vipassana, when the emphasis has been on more investigating moment-to-moment experience. There can be a collectedness that arises around moment-to-moment experience. So we can be aware of moment-to-moment experiences, but it can feel quite jangled, right? We can be investigating it, but it can feel still fragmented and still very much separate. Like, I'm here, it's there, I'm getting it in little bits and pieces. So we're investigating it, but the samadhi is kind of the state of like unification around the present moment's experience as it's happening, as it's flowing. So opening to change, not resisting change, kind of letting go of tightening and clinging as much as possible, leads to that kind of immersion in the present moment. Yeah.
I grew up with a Hindu practice, and I might have misinterpreted, but you know, when I was a kid, I would meditate, and when I would, the goal was concentration.
Yeah.
You know, I was just concentrating. And so when I came into a Vipassana practice much later, I kind of pushed away the concentration.
Yeah.
This is what I'm doing now as opposed to that.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I heard that it could possibly be complementary was a couple of years ago on the retreat. But I actually haven't heard very often teachers speak about So I thought today I feel like I get it. You know, the gathering and nurturing of energy to push towards the investigation. So this was very helpful.
Beautiful. Thank you. So just a comment, I'm not sure how much people can hear, but I grew up with a Hindu practice where the goal was concentration. That was the end, seemed to be the end point, which everything was culminating towards. And so coming to Vipassana, feeling as though the insight practice, shying away from that completely, or kind of maybe undervaluing it a little bit and unsure how it wove in maybe to the other factors of the Eightfold Path, and how calming and Vipassana might work together. So he feels like he's getting more of a sense of that. But beautiful. Thank you for sharing that experience. And that was the Buddha's experience as well, I believe, from my understanding. He kind of mastered all sorts of concentration practices, but found that it was helpful, but it didn't alleviate suffering. So, but it is one factor of the path. We don't just cut off that factor of the path, because he did that and it didn't work in its entirety. It works beautifully in conjunction with the other factors, conjunction with wise view, always kind of mitigated by effort, you know, not over-efforting, not under-efforting, this more continuous flowing mindfulness. So really starting to appreciate how the different factors of the path support and are like indispensable, right? You can't pull one apart and make it the whole. So beautiful that way. And I think maybe we're just about at time. I think there's some announcements tonight and I want to leave enough space for that. So I want to really thank you again for your attention tonight. I hope some of this has been useful, and full permission, as always, to take what's useful and leave the rest, right? Full permission. And also, you'll have the whole rest of the month. So Tim may have a different view on wise concentration. Looking forward to hearing it. So again, this is one take on it. What's been most helpful for me? Okay, so thank you.